This is EdgeCases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Wolf French.
And what's our topic this week, Wolf?
Floating point numbers.
Really?
Really.
Where you're just going to, like, you know, recite a couple for the 40 minutes?
There's an infinite number of floating point numbers, so that's more than enough for this episode.
Our episode could be very long this week. All right. So before we do that, I do have one thing to mention about last week's episode, which is that it could have, if it had gone a little bit differently, it could have had a different title, and it could have had actually one of what I would consider to be one of the top five titles of the ones that I have thought of that I've said on the show. But it didn't. And it didn't because that name was the name of the sample project that I was working on. Mm-hmm. And since I never shipped that sample project because it didn't actually work, when I was kind of, you know, slimming things down in my notes to make sure that it would all fit and I wouldn't be taking too much extra time, I didn't make a special note of saying what its title was. But now Wolf, you know what the title is, right? Because what I did after the show was over was I said, wow, this is such a good title that I'm going to record an afterword just so I can say, hey, we're using this title even though I didn't mention it on the show. And Wolf was very nice. He went ahead and edited that in. We don't normally do edits on our audio.
Because we're perfect the first time.
We're very, well, not even close, but because we don't have a high level of professionalism. And so I went ahead and I listened to the whole thing and I listened to it with you afterward. And I said, you know what? It's just too much. It's just me making too much of a big deal about this thing. So, you know, I went with a much more bland title just for the sake of that. But the name of the topic, the name of the project was You Bet Your Asset Catalog, which I realized, you know, I had to kind of say it in such. The only way it would have worked is if I had said it and Wolf had reacted. I think, you know, it's got to be in the show. You know, like it's really, I don't know. I think it's been more of a thing for me about the show that it's about our interaction than it is just about one of us talking. Mm. So
is that why it's so weird when you like try to do a monologue and you just don't get the feedback? You kind of need the other person to react.
Yeah. And I know, you know, there have been times when, and I know, you know, because we haven't necessarily practiced this stuff. I think we've gotten better at kind of being able to cut in on each other. And I suspect that on some other shows that do editing, they might do some editing to make those cut-ins work better than when you're just trying to talk over the other person to make them stop. But who knows? But yeah, anyway. So, and even that wasn't a very good delivery. Like what I really wanted to say was something like, you know, you bet your asset catalog, you know, something like, oh, you know what, it doesn't work now. All right, moving on. All right, off we go.
To the very exciting topic of floating point numbers.
Well, we'll see.
Yes.
I'm curious what you're actually going to, you know, how you're going to fill 35 minutes.
My notes are probably way beyond what we can actually fit into this. this is actually a really good Edge Cases show topic because it is floating point numbers are this rife with edge cases, and as is really kind of the entire field. So if you'll excuse a bit of a philosophical backgrounder here, is that to begin with, numbers in general are just really a model. So one of my favorite quotes that I use in my Singleton talk as well is from a statistician, George E.P. Box, and the quote is that all models are wrong, some models are useful. And one of the things about like this numbers in general is that, you know, we just kind of assume that you know they're reality, and really what they are is just that they're convenient fiction. They're a model that matches very well with reality and are useful for a bunch of things, but they are a model. And you might say, well, you know, obviously we can, you know, numbers are science and we can use numbers to predict things. And yes, you can, but I kind of came up with this analogy that isn't very good at all. But it's kind of like, imagine you're on the beach at a resort and you look up at the hotel you're staying at, the resort you're staying in, and you end up just like spending the next few hours kind of modeling a sandcastle of the resort, right? So it's like the hotel you're staying in, you build a sandcastle representation of it. Now, imagine that you like go all Godzilla on it, and you smash it at the end of the day, you smash it with your foot. And, you know, if you probably could, like, you know, if you were, you know, 300 feet tall and you actually went up to the resort and stepped on it, there are a lot of the same stuff that would happen to the sandcastle would happen to that resort. And, but on the other hand, so that model works pretty well, but that, again, the model, the your little sandcastle is not the resort, it's not the hotel, it is a model. And if you would do things like maybe pour water on your sandcastle, that would react very differently than what it would happen to the actual hotel.
Well, one would hope, anyway.
Yeah, I guess it probably depends on how cheap out you're staying.
The shoddy contractors and things. Yeah.
So going back to numbers, not the spreadsheet, the actual numbers, the concept, is that you have, like, think of, like, Alice has three apples, and she gives one to Bob. And how many apples does Alice have left? And it's not a trick question, maybe it is. Because what I didn't say is that one of the apples is Granny Smith, and maybe one is a Red Delicious, maybe one is a Fuji. And, you know, for our purposes, it didn't matter what type of apples they were. In fact, you could, you know, if you really want to be pedantic about it, those weren't the same. You know, yeah, they fall in the category of apple, but they're really different things.
Right, right. When we say that there, you have a quantity of something, it's a simplification.
Yeah, yes, yes. A categorization and simplification. Exactly. You're throwing away information, and so, you know, the thing is that humans categorize. But the universe is discrete, that every, you know, even atoms aren't truly fungible. But usually it's good enough for our purposes, whatever we want to accomplish. And so number systems are pretty much exactly the same way, that they aren't reality, but they do a good job modeling reality, so they're really useful, so we use them for things. And in fact, they're so effective that we maybe even get a little bit confused about whether they are reality. And now for a long time, I thought that, you know, numbers were reality, that, you know, this was science, and, you know, this was truth, and it took me a long time to realize that that's actually just a model. But anyway, so going back to floating point numbers in general, so John D. Cook has a blog post, in which I'll link to, where he calls floating point numbers a leaky abstraction, and to me, this is actually probably a very good way to kind of sum up the problem. That, I mean, you know, we deal with numbers all throughout life. And so we're dealing with usually county numbers or natural numbers. And then we end up looking at these things, floating point numbers, and you're like, numbers, I know this. And it's kind of like the Jurassic Park thing, right? Yeah. But the thing is, you don't. And he ended up linking that blog.
Well, considering
post.
that wasn't Unix that she was looking at anyway.
Right, good point.
Makes sense.
But he linked to another blog post he wrote for Microsoft called Five Tips for Floating Point Programming. And it's kind of, some of the issues of, very pragmatic, but kind of an overview of what you have to deal with when you're dealing with floating point numbers. That things like testing for equality is that you probably shouldn't do that.
Or you can do it just won't work.
Well, you see, that's the thing. It's like, you know, again, you walk into it, you think, oh, numbers, I know this. I can test if 5 equals to 5. And in that case, those are both hard-coded and that actually work. But yes, if the two variables I think should be the same, it very easily could not. And I'll quote him here, that most floating point operations involve at least a tiny loss of precision. So even if two numbers are equal for all practical purposes, they may not be exactly equal down to the last bit. So the equality test is likely to fail.
Yep.
And so I know this is not your first floating point rodeo. So you seem very...
Title.
You seem very unsurprised by this. But I think it was one of these things that maybe new programmers just kind of... You know, they get bitten a few times and they learn it. And, you know, graybeards like ourselves, we just kind of, oh, yeah, of course, yeah, floating point numbers are weird this way. But they are weird. And
well, do they teach floating point, what floating points even are in school?
If we went to school, we probably would know that.
Yeah, right. Because if you were to learn, like, how they were. The details of their implementation, then it should fall out what the ramifications of that are. But if you were never really taught anything other than, well, yeah, they're fractional numbers, mm-hmm. then sure, you would make those sort of erroneous assumptions.
Yeah, yeah. So I have a bunch to say about that later. So I'll just round out these five tips that, because I think they do a good job of kind of highlighting kind of mapping out the terrain here of what we have to deal with. So basic thing like testing for quality, you shouldn't really do it floating point numbers. So you have like a program that's using, you know, integers. And if you could, like, oh man, this now needs to be a decimal number or something, like, I'm going to turn this into a float or a double. Your program won't work the same way. It's not like you're just able to handle more numbers now or a different type of number. It's like your program now has different semantics, and that's pretty significant. Another thing that's kind of counterintuitive is that you should worry more about addition and subtraction than multiplication and division. That the relative error, again quoting here, the relative errors in multiplication and division are always small. Addition and subtraction, on the other hand, can result in complete loss of precision. So again, it's one of these things where it doesn't really fit like maybe your intuitive understanding of how numbers work, is that as soon as you engage a floating point types, all of a sudden you're in this different world where things act very differently. And then floating point numbers have finite ranges. Of course, you know, all integers and numbers have limits to how much you're willing to store, although I'll talk a little bit about alternatives to that later. And so you can do something like assign a number 16,777,216 to a floating point number. And if you were to, and you know, you're, again, because you're a graybeard, you pretty much, I think you already recognize that number is in a range that probably would sell some alarm bells. But if you were to print off that and print it off that as maybe F and then F plus 1, that number would come out the same twice. And the reason for that is because you've exhausted what's called Mantissa, which is where the certain significant bits are. And we'll talk a little bit about the layout, about how these floating point numbers are actually built. But so you think that adding one to this one floating point number would be, you know, good enough, but you've exhausted it, and your program will quote-unquote work, but it will give the wrong answer. You should use logarithms to avoid overflow and underflow, which we'll talk a little bit about that later. It's a way of kind of like kind of downshift your numbers to not be so large, so you're less likely to overflow them as you're working with them, and then you can make them large again towards the end. And also, a big point here is that numeric operations don't always return numbers. So actually adding up two numbers even adding can return a number that's not even a number, or NaN. You have to deal with these things where there are special sentinel values known as NaNs and infinities. And there are also two types of NaNs, singling NaNs and non-singling, whatever. But anyway, quiet NaNs, that's it. So our friend...
All I know is that there's infinity and there's negative infinity, right?
There's infinity, there's negative infinity, there's zero, there's negative zero.
Negative zero, that's right. Oh, that killed me.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, negative zero would be a great name for a band. Probably already is. So our friend of the show who writes at Ridiculous Fish has a very, very good post on this. He wrote a while back, which you could tell was written a while back because it's actually written for PowerPC machines, so the Indian issues are kind of screwed up now. But the title of this is called Float. Yes. And what he does is that he walks through kind of like how you build up these in these floating point numbers, and kind of like if you understand how they're actually built, it helps understand kind of the trade-offs that had to be made.
Yep.
Because there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. Another quote I like. And so I already talked about the Mantissa, which is he gives a concrete example here. So let's start with why we have floating point notation at all. Or how this stuff works, is that he gives an example of you have a really small, really, really, really small number. And the number he has is 0.00000000004381. And that's a lot of zeros to say. And unfortunately, we don't have a thing like Dunder score Or wait,
not yet. We could invent one. We could invent one right now.
Well, we have scientific notation, so sorry, we don't need. We solved this in the general case.
Fair enough.
So when you're dealing with these really large or really small numbers, obviously all of these zeros just kind of get in the way, and it's easy to lose track of them. So we have this concept of scientific notation. So instead of writing all those zeros or talking about all the zeros and saying all those zeros, and then what's actually significant, we can talk about the significant part first, which is 4381. And we can write in scientific notation where we say, and it's kind of like a micro, like basically a little formula there. It's just like, so we can express this as 4.381 times 10 to the minus 13th power. And so if you actually do the math on that, you end up with that same number. But you can start to say, oh, there's, you know, that there are 10, there are 13 zeros in there. Or I don't even, are there 13 zeros? I think so. And close, or at least 13 enough. Places, maybe they're not 13 zeros. But so the idea is that you can talk about kind of the significant bits first, and or significant numbers first, and then you can kind of compress it down, kind of as a run length encoding type thing. For you compression buffs out there, where you can just talk about how many zeros there are instead of having to actually have to say them all out.
You think we have compression buffs who listen to this podcast?
Oh, come on. aren't you a compression buff? Isn't everyone?
It's more of a hobby.
So the terminology here is that the Mentesa holds the significant bits of the 4.381. And we have a limited kind of buffer to deal with here, right? So they tend to be 32 bits or 64 bits, the one will fit into a register. And so we end up dividing these into certain ways. And the Mentesa is the one that was the significant bits, that 4.381 thing. And then we can deal with the exponent, which that would be the, like, how many zeros there are type thing. And there are different ways to construct these types of things. The example I gave used, 10 to the 10 to the minus 13th power. But it turns out that for better or for worse, that computers are binary, and we tend to use binary just natively to represent this. And I have a lot more to talk about later. Like I said, this could be a very long episode.
Two-parter.
There we go. Two-parter on floating point numbers. Wow. Okay. That'd be terrible. that larger part is the exponent. And so what you tend to encode there is like how many significant bits there are, and that's the float and floating point, the how many bits there's fixed point also. That might be easier to start with. Fixed point sets aside a certain number of bits for both the Mentesa and the exponent, and that's all you get. And that was common back in the Mac 68K days and 8-bit computer systems as well. This entire thing where we have hardware support for floating point numbers is somewhat recent. I say probably we used to have to buy separate chips called floating point units.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
Yeah. And I would say like even in the mid 90s, like a lot of computers didn't have floating point units. Or it was optional and you could, plug them in. So you have to do it all yourself in software using this integer calculations. But pretty much that got cheap enough that all got rolled in, and now we don't care about that. This, everything has it built in nowadays, unless you're probably like doing embedded systems or something like that. So it's basically – so that those numbers is that how you end up coding into those 32 or 64 bits, how much you set aside for each. Pretty much they both scale pretty linearly, and 64 bits obviously can represent more numbers. When I gave you that example float that we were assigning 60 million to and we added 1-2 and it didn't budge, floats – under C, probably depends on your architecture, but at least in the common case, are 32 bits, and they only set enough bits to hold that number, that 60 million number. So it's easy to overflow, and some of the behavior there is very tricky, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. And so I recommend you read Ridiculous Fishes article here, because it not only kind of lays out how these flowing points are constructed, but also that he tells you how to actually create one and see this, like, kind of jamming numbers together and then printing them out, seeing if your theories hold of how this works. And then he talks about a little bit of the special numbers, about, like, not numbers and infinities, stuff like that. And also, probably the best part of the article is towards the end, where he draws a graph about the accuracies of these floating point numbers and how there's this thing that's called gradual underflow, which I'll talk a little bit more in detail later. And if you look at it, it's one of these charts that this kind of will really rapidly kind of sum up, like, the accuracy trade-offs. Because the idea is that as these numbers get bigger, they become less accurate. So if you end up doing calculations that where a number explodes in size and gets preened back down to something reasonable towards the end of the calculation, you've suffered accuracy loss. And it's one of these things that it's really easy to do to yourself without realizing what's going on, or writing code that seems perfectly fine, maybe, and probably would be fine if we were, like, dealing with integers or something like that, or at least with integers, a failure might be, you might overflow and you might immediately see that you're throwing away information. But for better or for worse, the current floating point system we have, it ends up trying to shield you from yourself and do the right thing, even with the term here is numerically unsophisticated programmers. Like I said, a link to that blog post is great. You definitely need to read that, even though it's a little bit of outdate. If someone wants to, like, port it to Intel so that we can update the article so people can, you know, build floating point numbers from scratch on their current Intel Macs. That'd be great. So I've already talked about floating point units. I've already talked about fixed point units. Okay, good. Oh, yes. So when I was talking about the numerically unsophisticated programmers, a lot of this actually comes back to episode 61, where a cryptography tourist, where we talk about, like, domain tourists and all this. And this is pretty much the same issue being applied to simple math, right? Yeah. And that's kind of the attractive nuisance of floating point numbers, is that you say, oh, they're numbers. I know how to add numbers. And no, they operate in different ways. They have different behavior. And I would almost say this is for worse, that the standard floating point implementations we have today lull you into this false sense of security, because it's meant to try and it knows that you're unsophisticated and tries to save you from yourself. So you can walk farther into deep end than maybe you know you are, and then the wave comes in and sweeps you into the ocean. I don't know what's with all these beef metaphors, but there you go.
I was thinking then the shark comes in and, you know.
There you go.
Yeah.
So whenever you talk about floating point implementations, all this, the seminal paper on the topic, which pretty much everyone talks about and links to, is What Every Computer Scientist Should Know About Floating Point Arithmetic. And I'll link to that. And it was written by Goldberg. What was his first name? I forget. David Girl. Goldberg. There we go. And it is a fantastic article, very, very deep in it was like appendix to some book, but it was pulled out and reprinted by permission, and it talks about a lot of this implementation stuff. But unfortunately, there's tons of equations in it, and it's long, and no one really cares about this stuff. So so it tends to be...
Except you.
Well, even I, you know, even I haven't... I don't think I've read every single word of this thing, because yeah. You know, even I, my eyes glaze over, because I've never written a floating point implementation. It's not like TCP stacks, right? Right, or which I yearn to... re-implement, right? This stuff is like I'm all
no,
kind
no.
Of
I think TCP stacks are still just you, but yeah.
So I have this. It's one of these things where I'm just kind of pissed off that it doesn't all this magically work all the time, even though I understand all the trade-offs, right? But anyway. So the problem with this paper, even though it's always cited, is, like I said, it's a great paper that I haven't read because it. whatever. So what the paper that I actually prefer, and it's not really a paper, it was apparently abbreviated version of it, appeared in the March 1998 issue of IEEE Computer. But it's essentially, it's an interview. It's the title is An Interview with the Old Man of Floating Point.
Gosh.
And I believe it's the guy is the old man of Floating Point, as it were, is William Cahan. And I believe the author of it is Charles Severance. And this, to me, this is actually a lot – this is written more of a kind of historical standpoint. And it's talking about the birth of IEEE 754. And IEEE 754 is the standard for Floating Point hardware that we are running in all modern computers today. And the first version was 1985, I believe, and then they did a newer rev of it, I think, in 2008, fairly recent. Those numbers, those days might be slightly wrong, but... and
right, because I think the one point here is that the C implementation of floating point numbers is also generally the hardware implementation of floating point numbers, correct?
Exactly, yes.
So, I mean, that's why you can't, like... languages which say, well, we'll give you a different kind of floating point value, then means they have to write their own implementation because they can't use what's directly in the hardware.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, we all had to write our own software implementations before FPUs became really standardized, but at least when you had the FPU socket, even if it was empty, if you had to do it in software, you would still follow the 754 spec, even in software, because you knew that that way the person that's going to plug in a piece of hardware and your software would run a lot faster. But anyway... so the basic, like this interview is fantastic the way it's written, because much like the top of the show when I was talking about how like numbers almost seem like reality unless like truth from above and stuff like this. Like for a long time, I approached IEEE 754 as like this is just how things are. This is, you know, this is the reality. This is reality or high fidelity representation reality. And the great thing about this article is that. It's, you know, there were a bunch of decisions that humans had to make.
Yeah.
And one of them is the entire idea of gradual underflow. And they were trying to save programmers from themselves. And also, the like, decisions in terms of rounding and how things should work. And it turns out that, as I pointed out in the beginning of this article, that if you were a programmer of floating point computations on different computers in the 1960s and 1970s, you had to cope with a wide variety of floating point hardware, and that things that would work on one hardware would not work on the other, and you would end up with weird things where you're like, you know, assigning X to X just by itself, so you'd get some sort of behavior of the floating point unit in terms of truncation that would then make it work on anything else, but it was relevant to all the other machines. And so there was like a lot of all these decisions that, you know, that kind of ended up being written down in IEEE 754 were all these ideas varied, right? It was very kind of like genetically diverse amongst all these different hardware platforms. And so IEEE 754 is actually the story behind it is also very interesting because we can pretty much thank Intel for it because they were. They were coming out with their own floating point microprocessor and with a microcode implementation. And basically, all the other microprocessor vendors were worried that Intel would kind of rule the market with it. And so, so they all end up for political reasons, like want to standardize this thing. Hopefully slowing Intel down. And but anyway, like I said, great process.
Or being able to keep up with them.
Right. Right. And it talks a lot about how, like, back then, like, the DEC VAX was, like, the big floating point vendor. And once the IEEE commission was formed, organization or community or whatever, what do you call those IEEE things, they're pushing pretty hard and pretty successfully for this, you know, they were the dominant player in the floating point, and you thus should use us. And where they actually had a bunch of good ideas, probably arguably better ideas than how DEC was doing things. And I just realized we're mentioning DEC again. I'm like, well, the show mentions Digital Equipment Corporation as much as I do. But anyway, so there's like I said, great article. I'll just leave it with that. So bringing us around, since this is supposedly an Apple flavored show, we can actually put this in terms of Objective-C. And in Cocoa, there's this class called NS Decimal Number. Have you ever had reason to use this class, Andrew?
I have not used it, no.
You've probably spotted it a few times, and you're like, oh, it's there. And that's pretty much, you know, I don't know if I've ever used it myself in anger, because like, I'm thinking about all the times I've... Well, I'm getting ahead of myself here, so let me talk about NSDecimal number. So NSDecimal number, as it describes itself, is a... bring up dash here, is that it is an object-oriented wrapper for doing base 10 arithmetic. And it can represent basically a decimal integer up to 38 digits long and with an exponent from minus 128 to 127. So again, powers of 2 to the 8th type stuff. 2 to 7th, I guess. so this is... there is... One of the things that... that really help with understanding this is that, you know, the entire thing of like viewing everything as a model and with trade-offs is that we are using these binary computers that, you know, have zeros and ones and are very good at what they do. And humans have these base 10 number systems. And it turns out that there are all sorts of edge cases when the two interact. And... it's doing something as simple as dividing 0.9 by 10 twice in a row will yield a different number in binary systems than what you expect in base 10 systems. And that's pretty much has to do with how these things are actually represented bitwise, that there's this there's a problem where, like, one third, the fraction, cannot be cleanly represented in floating point number. You have these like alternating bit patterns that repeat forever.
Mm-hmm.
And this is has led to all sorts of issues. It used to be like every other year, a new version of Windows, a new version of the Mac OS would come out, or some new platform. And the first thing is some joker would do is bring up the calculator and, you know, and show off one of these weird floating point artifacts and saying, see, this computer can't even do math. And I've actually tried to reproduce this on the current calculator.app on Apple, but Apple has switched to a much better implementation internally than they used to have. I think in 10.0, 10.1, they had this pretty much dealing with this like probably doubles that have all sorts of these type of floating point weird behaviors. And so, because humans deal with base 10 system and base 10 numbers, and because moving them back and forth between binary base 2 numbers is problematic, a much better way to deal with human numbers is actually using base 10. And so NSDecimal number will actually give you a pretty good it's kind of clumsy to use, but because everything has to be a method call type stuff. But it gives you a pretty good interface for dealing with this. So, for example, one thing you don't want to do, and like maybe this should be like the title of the show, it's like, don't use floating point numbers for money. which is not nearly as good as the other title. But
wait, is this going to turn into a Bitcoin episode?
I am Santoshi. So a lot of the weird behavior that we have with floating point numbers and how it can't represent like 0.33 cleanly, those errors are cumulative, and it's just floating point numbers in general, that is float and double type in Objective-C, are thus totally really unsuited for representing money. And so you want to use something like NSDecimal number if you want to represent currencies in there. There's a couple other things you could do that you can, instead of using a floating point number for representing, like, imagine you had like $1.23, so it's 1.23. Instead of representing that as a floating point number, you could actually represent it as 123 cents and thus keep that as a standard integer.
Mm-hmm.
If you're worried that what happens if you want to, you know, deal with fractions of a cent, well, then you can, you know, deal with millicents type stuff, where this you just multiply by 1,000, and that'll probably give you all the accuracy you need without all this floating point weirdness. like, for example, one of the weirdnesses is that floating point addition is not associative. That this guy, Chris Vest, had wrote this nice little, I think it was actually in Java. I thought it was C at first glance, but it looks like it's Java, where he did this a test where he there's an operate. Well, let me walk you through this. So an operation is cumulative if the order of the operands don't matter. So A plus B is equal to B plus A.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So plus operation is cumulative. An operation is associative if the order of the operations don't matter. So if you have A times B times C, and you do B times C first, it would be associative if you multiplied A plus B first. And it turns out floating point, because of how because it's weird, it is not associative. So adding up strings of floating point numbers, depending on which order you add them, will give you different answers.
You have different answers, Jim.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So I said you can use like the millicent route if you want to do that. Another interesting thing is this thing called binary coded decimal, and it's instead of trying to be very space efficient, instead every 4 bits it's set aside for. It's kind of like hexadecimal. That every 4 bits is set aside from a number from 0 to 10, and you waste some space there because those 4 bits could encode 16 values and you're encoding 10. But there's also a packed decimal format that tries to be more space efficient. But anyway, that's kind of the gold standard for actually manipulating these numbers, because much like how fixed point and floating point numbers are implemented using binary digits, you can also implement them in binary coded decimal. And you don't have suffered any of the weirdness of the floating point numbers if you do it that way. And what's interesting is that the original, and this is actually where I first ran into binary coded decimal, the original 68,000 processor that Max ran on actually had hardware support for at least adding binary coded decimal numbers. So because they figured, hey, this would be good for businesses. And I guess I wouldn't be surprised if Intel architecture has support for it. I just haven't noticed it yet, because man, what a closet heap of instructions and okay. So I talked about one of the things that's really funny is that JavaScript only has one number type, and that's double, and so there's no escape hatch for doing things the right way in JavaScript. It's just you have to be aware of all the weirdness of floating point numbers all the time and try to do the right thing all the time.
Or just don't use numbers in JavaScript.
There we go.
when probably somebody created like a class of a number class that's more like an integer.
Yeah, one thing is that JavaScript has, in the past 2 years, have gotten a lot better in dealing with this binary strings, and a lot of stuff is just being built on top of that. So that's I was mentioned before that there's a lot that you can use it, that we have finite amount of space that we have to deal with all this stuff. One thing that I wish was a lot more prevalent. So I guess my wish list includes more binary code decimal support and everything, and more big num supports. So big num is kind of like the catch-all term for arbitrary precision arithmetic, where you don't have these weird underflows or overflows type stuff. Is that as you need more precision, instead of trying to jam it all into 32, 64, or 80 bits, that it will just, the number will grow as needed. And this apparently is like a staple in Common Lisp and other languages. And libraries like OpenSSL that has to do with a lot of crypto, they have their own big number classes and all that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that's just, for some reason or another, is just not common at all in mainstream libraries, which is kind of sad.
Is it not? Is there not a Java implementation of that?
I think there might be. Back in my Java days, I don't remember it being built in, but maybe it's even built in now.
But they've added all sorts of crap since we programmed Java.
That's true. Maybe they have. Mm-hmm. And finally, what kind of kicked this off, this has been sitting in my topics to talk about for a very long time. And what finally kicked it over the ledge was that Douglas Crockford, which is a pretty big JavaScript name, has come out with his DEC64 format. So if you go to DEC64.com, essentially it's... I'll just read a little bit here. It's a number type. It can precisely represent decimal fractions with 16 decimal places. And so it makes it well suited to applications that are concerned with money. So I was telling you how binary numbers don't fit very well with money. So he ends up, this is a decimal number type, so it's a base 10 system. And he pretty much wants it to be kind of a standard type stuff. And it is, from what I can tell, it seems very nice, and it seems pretty fast. And he includes a x86 assembly implementation, all that. And he basically wants to kind of like, get past the fact that IEEE 754 binary floating point has invaded monetary applications. And he actually would prefer that DEC64 kind of become the standard numeric variable type for everything. Like, so I mentioned how JavaScript only has a double as its numeric type. He actually would want to have DEC64 as the numeric type for everything. So they would, and so in C, you know, we have our char and our shorts and our longs and its integers and all that. And this could be replaced with a DEC64, which I think is hopelessly optimistic, especially because we are dealing with more and more bigger than more than 64-bit numbers. Like ZFS, famously, how big is that? Like 128 bits to 256 bits? It's pretty big. So I think it's probably, and also 64-bit numbers, as large as they seem, is that they are, if you're doing a lot of math, it's easy to even temporarily exceed what can be represented by them and go into overflow land, and now you're throwing away precision type stuff. So it's probably, I like his work here, but I think it's too, maybe overly optimistic.
Well, and when did he come up with this?
I think he just announced, I don't think it might have not been officially announced yet, but like someone was looking at his GitHub repo.
So it's recent though. I mean, I would think that sort of a quest would have been more likely to come about like maybe 3 to 5 years ago, before 64-bit had sort of taken things over and made it likely that you'd need larger number types right away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so I guess my takeaway here is avoid floating point if you can. Kind of understand the weird stuff it will throw at you.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Okay. Well, a couple of things. I mean, I think one point to reiterate, you pretty much covered it, but I want to reiterate that, I mean, the reason why we came up with this format, which has all of these downsides to it, is because we wanted it to be relatively small and relatively quick.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so those are the two, like, you know, if all these numbers could fit in, 20 bytes or whatever for each one, then you wouldn't have to make these kind of trade-offs about accuracy. It would all,
sure,
you could fit as much information as you want in there. Instead, you know, we wanted to fit it into 32 bits or 64 bits or whatever. And that, you know, that involves a lot of trade-offs.
Yeah.
And you wanted to make it something which you could put in hardware and then it would be pretty fast. Mm-hmm. And that also involved a lot of trade-offs. You can almost, I would think that it should be possible, you know, you said don't use floating point. If you want to use a different number class, basically, an object which can handle, it should be pretty easy to find implementations which are more accurate. The trouble is, you know, they'll be bigger,
they'll
be slower, but that might be what you need. The other thing that I was thinking of was that, you know, the place that I use floating point all the time is CGFloat for coordinates for things, for sizes of things. And for those, because you're generally dealing with the size of a screen, you're not generally dealing with the cases where you're going to have these addition, subtraction, multiplication problems, because these numbers are still within relatively small bounds and you're not going to get beyond it. You're not going to go, you know, you don't have a screen coordinate of 10,000,000.1, you know, so you're okay with that. And I think that's why that might be what lulls a lot of people into this a sense of false confidence, is because they say, well, of course, I've used fractional numbers, I've used floating point numbers for graphics for my entire career. And so, of course, I should just be able to now use them for these other mathematical values that I need with no problems, because they worked for the graphics. And yeah, that's when you run into problems. I think if I had an application, and I guess I haven't had one yet, where I knew I was going to use very large numbers, I would try my damnedest to make sure that I'm using a more accurate representation, or even not necessarily a general purpose, more accurate representation, but just a more specialized representation that would be accurate within what I needed. Because again, you probably aren't going to find that you can use these giant implementations everywhere. Like if you do need speed, if you're adding a lot of numbers, maybe you can't use that, but you could still use something which where the trade-offs are less risky for you in your circumstances. Because, you know, again, there are a lot of compromises that went into floating point numbers that you may not need. Those compromises, you may need another set of compromises.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I think it was, I seem to remember it was something like GNU Cash or something, switched from using doubles for the representation of money to something like fixed. And that was the right call for that, because it was the error conditions were much more tractable and it had less weirdness. Even though I think maybe size wise, like, it's still on par with probably bit for bit, you know, same size. Yeah. But yeah, that's it was the correct set of trade offs for them.
I think money would probably be one. I would think anything involving like math, just you know, you're calculating some, I don't know, like astronomical distances or something, you know, that sort of thing.
Right? Yeah, I would say there's a difference between personal finance numbers, which maybe you have thousands of them, and you can have a pretty, you know, especially if they represent currency type stuff, you have are a lot different versus astronomical data, which is all over the map. I guess literally.
Indeed. All right, and so if that's it.
Oh, you know what? I actually realized I skipped one bullet point, so let's tack this on. NS decimal. So there, I already mentioned NS decimal number, and that's Objective-C class. There's also NS decimal, which is pretty old school. I think it shipped with 10.0. It is a struct instead of Objective-C class, you manipulate it with a bunch of C functions. And but it has the same, pretty much the same trade-offs that is, you know, base 10 system, and in terms of capacities, numeric capacities. And Brad Larson, back in 2009 on the Core Plot main list, measured the performance of this guy, and he pretty much clocked it as being 5 times faster than NS decimal number. So it was he was clocking in 3.3 million additions per second versus NS decimal numbers about 670,000. Although interestingly enough, the division they got much closer, which you would think that computers are so fast nowadays that it doesn't, you know, we basically do get divisions free, but I guess not. Divisions apparently was slow enough in his tests that they actually kind of the gap significantly narrowed in performance. So that's definitely something to look at if you actually have to sling a lot of decimal numbers and you want to stay in CocoaLand.
You want to stay in CocoaLand, and you don't want to write your own implementation because, even if you do need, you do need different trade-offs, you should really probably try to find someone else's implementation than writing your own.
Yeah, it's kind of like the cryptography thing again. It's like, so you're not as smart as you think you are. You should probably try to use other people's brains for this.
Well, we certainly aren't as smart as we think we are.
Right, exactly.
So there you go. Alrighty, so now?
Yeah, now we can actually determine.
Okay, great. So we'll see you next time.